An essay upon projects. Contents. Introduction. Authors. Preface. Authors. Introduction. The history of projects of projectors of banks of the multiplicity of banks of the highways of assurances of friendly societies of seamen of wagering of fools a charity lottery of bankrupts of academies of a court merchant of seamen the conclusion. Introduction. Defoe's essay on projects was the first volume he published, and no great writer ever published a first book more characteristic in expression of his tone of thought. It is practical in the highest degree, while running over with fresh speculation, that seeks everywhere the well-being of society by growth of material and moral power. There is a wonderful fertility of mind, and almost whimsical precision of detail, with good sense and good humor to form the groundwork of a happy English style. Defoe in this book ran again and again into sound suggestions that first came to be realized long after he was dead. Upon one subject, indeed, the education of women, we have only just now caught him up. Defoe wrote the book in 1692 or 1693, when his age was a year or two over 30, and he published it in 1697. Defoe was the son of James Foe, of St. Giles, Cripplegate, whose family had owned grazing land in the country, and who himself throve as a meat salesman in London. James Foe went to Cripplegate Church, where the minister was Dr. Ansley. But in 1662, a year after the birth of Daniel Foe, Dr. Ansley was one of the 3,000 clergymen who were driven out of their benefices by the Act of Uniformity. James Foe was then one of the congregation that followed him into exile, and looked up to him as spiritual guide when he was able to open a meeting house in Little St. Helens. Thus Daniel Foe, not yet Defoe, was trained under the influence of Dr. Ansley, and by his advice sent to the Academy at Newington Green, where Charles Morton, a good Oxford scholar, trained young men for the pulpits of the nonconformists. In later days, when driven to America by the persecution of opinion, Morton became vice president of Harvard College. Charles Morton sought to include in his teaching at Newington Green a training in such knowledge of current history as would show his boys the origin and meaning of the controversies of the day in which, as men, they might hereafter take their part. He took pains, also, to train them in the use of English. We were not, Defoe said afterwards, destitute of language, but we were made masters of English. And more of us excelled in that particular than of any school at that time. Daniel Foe did not pass on into the ministry for which he had been trained. He said afterwards, in his review, it was my disaster first to be set apart for, and then to be set apart from, the honor of that sacred employ. At the age of about 19 he went into business as a hose factor in Freeman's Court, Cornhill. He may have bought succession to a business, or sought to make one in a way of life that required no capital. He acted simply as broker between the manufacturer and the retailer. He remained at the business in Freeman's Court for 7 years, subject to political distractions. In 1683, still in the reign of Charles II, Daniel Foe, aged 22, published a pamphlet called Presbytery Rodron. Charles died on the 6th of February, 1685. On the 14th of the next June the Duke of Monmouth landed at Lyme with 83 followers, hoping that Englishmen enough would flock about his standard to overthrow the government of James II, for whose exclusion, as a Roman Catholic, from the succession to the throne there had been so long a struggle in his brother's reign. Daniel Foe took leave of absence from his business in Freeman's Court, joined Monmouth, and shared the defeat at Sedgemoor on the 6th of July. Judge Jeffreys then made progress through the West, and Daniel Foe escaped from his clutches. On the 15th of July Monmouth was executed. Daniel Foe found it convenient at that time to pay personal attention to some business affairs in Spain. His name suggests an English reading of a Spanish name, Foa, and more than once in his life there are indications of friends in Spain about whom we know nothing. Daniel Foe went to Spain in the time of danger to his life, for taking part in the rebellion of the Duke of Monmouth, and when he came back he wrote himself Defoe. He may have heard Pettigrew discussed among his Spanish friends. He may have wished to avoid drawing attention to a name entered under the letter F in a list of rebels. He may have played on the distinction between himself and his father, still living, that one was Mr. Foe, the other Mr. Defoe. He may have meant to write much, and wishing to be a friend to his country, meant also to deprive punsters of the opportunity of calling him a foe. Whatever his chief reason for the change, we may be sure that it was practical. In April, 1687, James II issued a declaration for liberty of conscience in England, by which he suspended penal laws against all Roman Catholics and nonconformists, and dispensed with oaths and tests established by the law. This was a stretch of the king's prerogative that produced results immediately welcome to the nonconformists, who sent up addresses of thanks. Defoe saw clearly that a king who is thanked for overruling an unwelcome law has the whole point conceded to him of right to overrule the law. In that sense he wrote a letter containing some reflections on His Majesty's declaration for liberty of conscience, to warn the nonconformists of the great mistake into which some were falling. Was ever anything, he asked afterwards, more absurd than this conduct of King James and his party, in wheedling the dissenters, giving them liberty of conscience by his own arbitrary dispensing authority, and his expecting they should be content with their religious liberty at the price of the Constitution? In the letter itself he pointed out that the king's suspending of laws strikes at the root of this whole government, and subverts it quite. The Lords and Commons have such a share in it, that no law can be either made, repealed, or, which is all one, suspended, but by their consent. In January, 1688, Defoe, having inherited the freedom of the City of London, took it up, and signed his name in the Chamberlain's book, on the 26th of that month, without the de, Daniel Foe. On the 5th of November, 1688, there was another landing, that of William of Orange, in Torbay, which threatened the government of James II. Defoe again rode out, met the army of William at Henley on Thames, and joined its second line as a volunteer. He was present when it was resolved, on the 13th of February, 1689, that the flight of James had been an abdication, and he was one of the mounted citizens who formed a guard of honor when William and Mary paid their first visit to Guildhall. Defoe was at this time 28 years old, married, and living in a house at Tooting, where he had also been active in foundation of a chapel. From whose factor he had become merchant adventurer in trade with Spain, and is said by one writer of his time, to have been a civet cat merchant. Failing then in some venture in 1692 he became bankrupt, and had one vindictive creditor who, according to the law of those days, had power to shut him in prison, and destroy all power of recovering his loss, and putting himself straight with the world. Until his other creditors had conquered that one enemy, and could give him freedom to earn money again, and pay his debts, when that time came he proved his sense of honesty to much larger than the letter of the law. Defoe left London for Bristol, and there kept out of the way of arrest. He was visible only on Sunday, and known, therefore, as the Sunday Gentleman. His lodging was at the Red Lion Inn, in Castle Street. The house, no longer an inn, still stands, as numbers 80 and 81 in that street. There Defoe wrote this essay on projects. He was there until 1694, when he received offers that would have settled him prosperously in business at Cadiz, but he held by his country. The check on free action was removed, and the government received with favor a project of his, which is not included in the essay, for raising money to supply the occasions of the war then newly begun. He had also a project for the raising of money, to supply his own occasions by the establishment of Pantle Works, which proved successful. Defoe could not be idle. In a desert island he would, like his Robinson Crusoe, have spent time, not in lamentation, but in steady work to get away. H.M., Author's Preface. To Dalby Thomas, Esq., one of the commissions for managing His Majesty's duties on glass, and see, sir, this preface comes directed to you, not as commissioner, and see under whom I have the honor to serve His Majesty, nor as a friend, though I have great obligations of that sort also, but as the most proper judge of the subjects treated of, and more capable than the greatest part of mankind, to distinguish and understand them. Books are useful only to such whose genius are suitable to the subject of them, and to dedicate a book of projects to a person who had never concerned himself to think that way would be like music to one that has no ear. And yet ear having a capacity to judge of these things no way brings you under the despicable title of a projector, any more than knowing the practices and subtleties of wicked men makes a man guilty of their crimes. The several chapters of this book are the results of particular thoughts occasioned by conversing with the public affairs during the present war with France. The losses and casualties which attend all trading nations in the world, when involved in so cruel a war as this, have reached us all, and I am none of the least sufferers. If this has put me, as well as others, on inventions and projects, so much the subject of this book, it is no more than a proof of the reason I give for the general projecting humor of the nation. One unhappiness I lie under in the following book, viz. : that having kept the greatest part of it by me for near 5 years, several of the thoughts seem to be hit by other hands, and some by the public, which turns the tables upon me, as if I had borrowed from them. As particularly that of the seamen, which you know well I had contrived long before the act for registering seamen was proposed. And that of educating women, which I think myself bound to declare, was formed long before the book called Advice to the Ladies was made public. And yet I do not write this to magnify my own invention, but to acquit myself from grafting on other people's thoughts. If I have trespassed upon any person in the world, it is upon yourself, from whom I had some of the notions about county banks, and factories for goods, in the chapter of banks, and yet I do not think that my proposal for the women, or the seamen clashes at all, either with that book, or the public method of registering seamen. I have been told since this was done, that my proposal for a commission of inquiries into bankrupt estates is borrowed from the Dutch. If there is anything like it among the Dutch, it is more than ever I knew, or know yet. But if so, I hope it is no objection against our having the same here, especially if it be true, that it would be so publicly beneficial as is expressed. What is said of friendly societies, I think no man will dispute with me, since one has met with so much success already in the practice of it. I mean the Friendly Society for Widows, of which you have been pleased to be a governor. Friendly societies are very extensive, and, as I have hinted, might be carried on to many particulars. I have omitted one which was mentioned in discourse with yourself, where 100 tradesmen, all of several trades, agree together to buy whatever they want of one another, and nowhere else, prices and payments to be settled among themselves, whereby every man is sure to have 99 customers, and can never want a trade. And I could have filled up the book with instances of like nature, but I never designed to fire the reader with particulars. The proposal of the pension office you will soon see offered to the public as an attempt for the relief of the poor, which, if it meets with encouragement, will every way answer all the great things I have said of it. I had wrote a great many sheets about the coin, about bringing in plate to the mint, and about our standard. But so many great heads being upon it, with some of whom my opinion does not agree, I would not adventure to appear in print upon that subject. Ways and means also I have laid by on the same score. Only adhering to this one point, that be it by taxing the wares they sell, be it by taxing them in stock, be it by composition which, By the way, I believe is the best, be it by what way soever the Parliament please, the retailers are the men who seem to call upon us to be taxed, if not by their own extraordinary good circumstances, though that might bear it, yet by the contrary in all other degrees of the kingdom. Besides, the retailers are the only men who could pay it with least damage, because it is in their power to levy it again upon their customers, in the prices of their goods, and is no more than paying a higher rent for their shops. The retailers of manufactures, especially so far as relates to the inland trade, have never been taxed yet, and their wealth or number is not easily calculated. Trade and land has been handled roughly enough, and these are the men who now lie as a reserve, to carry on the burden of the war. These are the men who, were the land tax collected as it should be, ought to pay the king more than that whole bill ever produced. And yet these are the men who, I think I may venture to say, do not pay a 20th part in that bill. Should the king appoint a survey over the assessors, and indict all those who were found faulty, allowing a reward to any discoverer of an assessment made lower than the literal sense of the act implies, what a register of frauds and connivances would be found out. In a general tax, if any should be excused, it should be the poor, who are not able to pay, or at least, are pinched in the necessary parts of life by paying. And yet here a poor laborer, who works for 12 pence or 18 pence a day, does not drink a pot of beer, but pays the king a tenth part for excise, and really pays more to the king's taxes in a year than a country shopkeeper, who is alderman of the town, worth perhaps 2,000 or 3,000 pounds, brews his own beer, pays no excise, and in the land taxes rated it may be at £100, and pays £1.4s. Per annum, but ought, if the act were put into execution, to pay £36 per annum to the king. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.